Three, two, one. Anthony Darby.
Shaw Ken.
Mary Pat Hoffman.
We have a special guest who's not really a guest. Is, of course, everyone knows who Dr. Hoffman, Mary Pat is. But we wanted to feature her this podcast because I think not everyone has really had a chance to hear your story in terms of how you got into the industry, kind of what you bring in your background, and most importantly, kind of the role that you play at PAH. Just to talk about some patient outcomes and just different things that we've done. I mean, truthfully, we all pride ourselves and our partners about us being a very clinically focused and medically centric cannabis dispensary. And without Dr. Hoffman, we don't have that. And I really appreciate how fate brought us together. I mean, I guess for those folks that don't really know how MP came into our lives. So Chuck Corpon and I have been great friends through college. Chuck and I were roommates. The three of us had, like we had mentioned previously, we had these aspirations to do something in this industry, basically anything other than a dispensary.
Anything but where we're at.
Is what we often joke, it's very truthfully said. And then when we decided we wanted to do a dispensary, for me, this was the very next piece of the puzzle, and that was my very first project that I took under my wing. I reached out to a couple close sources and had some different potential folks to fill this clinical director role that we needed, the kind of the medical face and the medical direction for our dispensary. And through my actual pharmacy and some circumstances, we were brought together. We went and had lunch at Mojo's in downtown Salisbury and literally went home that night and told Chuck and Corpon that I thought we needed to bring Dr. Hoffman on as an equal partner as soon as possible. And we had our team. That was the fourth person that we needed to really lock in the skill sets that we were going to need to go after this license. So
thank you guys for rescuing me.
So
we all rescued each other.
Well, let's do this. Let's tell your story about how cannabis as a medicine first came on your radar, and then we'll dive into a little bit of the application process and that piece of it.
So it was a while ago. It was probably 2003. I was working at a little pharmacy up in Bethany Beach and super quiet in the off season, but those people really became like our family. And I was working one evening and this guy was one of my regulars, came in, and his mom was diagnosed with cancer. He was her caretaker, and he leaned over the counter and looked all around and said, "I want my mom to smoke some pot, but she won't do it unless you say that it's okay." Well, I didn't know much about it then, and there wasn't the kind of information that's out there now. So I said, well, give me a couple days. I'll see what I can find out. And
you knew his mom really well, right?
Like, I knew both of them very well. She wouldn't do it unless I told her it was that she'd be all right. And I knew the son very well, and he had a friend that grew it, so I knew where it was going to be coming from.
And this wasn't like an average woman, right? Like, this lady was, like, knitting.
No, she was a sweetheart. I mean, she was very active in her community. Just one of those, like, little old ladies that everyone recognizes and knows and loves and very active and always out doing something for someone somewhere. But she was little and frail, and it really took its toll on her, and she was just really sick. She didn't handle the treatment well. She didn't handle the side effects well. And, you know, her son just kind of figured, with as sick as she was, let's give this a try. So with that, I kind of gave them my blessing, and he rolled his mom a few joints and she smoked them, and she came in a couple weeks later and just said, "I can't believe this, but turn this around for me." She was sleeping, she was eating, her mood was better. She just didn't feel so gross and sick all the time. And I think that sometimes when patients like that can eat and sleep and get a little bit of strength, that's such a big deal for them. And so for me, I just thought, I have watched this woman over all these years, like, in the pharmacy, take good care of herself. She ended up with cancer. Now she's in here spending a fortune on all this medication, all these antiemetics, all these things to help her feel better, and nothing worked. And she was distraught and sad and not doing well. And she smoked a couple joints and was dancing in the pharmacy. And so I thought, there's got to be something to this, because all of these things, and like, nothing helped.
So how did you become a pharmacist? Like, did you want to be a pharmacist out of high school, or like,
what was your... I just always kind of you know, I grew up allergic to everything that's not human, and even some humans I'm allergic to. So I used asthma medicine when I was younger. I took allergy medicine, and I just always thought it was pretty cool that you take something and it does some kind of magic in your body and you feel better. So I was interested in the study of pharmacy, but I didn't really like being a pharmacist. I think, like, you talk about working for the man.
So you come out of pharmacy school with these aspirations that you're going to go take on the world and heal everyone, and then you find yourself stuck in a retail pharmacy.
Well, yeah, it's not that fun. You know, you're on your feet. Everyone's yelling at you. They're dealing with, you know, ridiculous co-pays. You're dealing with insurance companies, not enough help.
Was insurance hell always hell? Like, from
no,
the day,
when I first got out of school, I remember Celebrex was the first time I ever heard the words prior authorization. And I'm standing in a pharmacy, like a slow grocery store pharmacy, so I had no help. And I'm like, what the fuck is a prior authorization? I had never seen it before.
What year
is that, you know? Like, you're
gonna age me, Darby. I'm just trying to understand.
Like, so how did it work before?
I wanna say it was 98.
Because honestly, like, I just wanna dive into a little bit. We talk a lot about cannabis, but like the pharmacy piece is something that, quite frankly, we do a pretty good job of mother effing all the time. I knew that it wasn't always like this, and I'm trying to better understand. So, like Chuck asked, so before prior authorizations, like your doctor wrote the prescription and you just filled it
and
you
billed it. Your insurance just paid for it,
right? But here's the thing. You weren't advertising at NASCAR races, and you weren't sponsoring Super Bowl halftime shows. So drugs did not need to be $2,000 for 1 month. That's what kind of started this whole shit show. Is back in the day, drugs were moderately priced despite all the R&D that somehow cost us a fortune today. What we pay for today is direct-to-consumer advertising. We pay for all these lawsuits. We pay to put patches on NASCAR racing, you know, on NASCAR jackets. We pay to sponsor. I mean, does Viagra need to, like, sponsor a halftime show? Does Lipitor? No. Like, let's save that money and let's pass that on to patients. But instead, someone's paying for that. It's not their CEOs.
Is that why all these things take so long to go through the insurance channels and they're so convoluted?
Well, yeah, because honestly, like, if you're an insurance company and someone's like, here's an anti-inflammatory, we're going to ask your insurance company for $800 a month.
Ibuprofen.
When we used to give them ibuprofen for $6, like, why would the insurance be like, all right? So that's what started this whole thing. And then insurance did not want to. I mean, I've been a pharmacist since 1997. I can't afford my asthma medication. Like, it's nuts. And, you know, we have drug reps that make a fortune. We have drug company CEOs that make a fortune. And we have millions of patients that can't afford their medicine.
It's so crazy to me, like, and like, as someone, you know, we have Peninsula Holistics, which is our CBD business, and like, as someone that now understands the dredges of how expensive it is to sell direct to consumer, I totally understand what Mary Pat is saying in terms of, like, before, all they were worrying about was educating physicians about this new drug that was out there instead of $1 million sponsorship to Dale Earnhardt Jr. on the 13 car. Like, that's, you know, all those things add up tremendously. And when you're going out trying, and you think about your consumption, I don't watch a lot of TV anymore, thank God. But when I did, I remember all the damn drug commercials,
yeah,
one
so
after
many.
Another. And like, they're comical. It's like,
and they're 2 minutes long because you have a minute of side effects.
That's like,
while someone's like having a picnic,
yeah, the micro
on a boat.
Machine guys, like, rah, 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 yeah, raiding them off. And then it's like a couple like dancing on a mountain somewhere for some drug that's for like, like, stop exercising. Just take 10 of these a day.
Reduce your cholesterol.
And like, you'll be picnicking with your granddaughter and there's this permanent smile on your face.
And, like, you know, for us, I was just actually, we had some practitioners come through today, and we were discussing the differences between, like, traditional pharmacy and cannabis, and they were saying, you know, how does Big Pharma play a role in what you guys are trying to do? And, I don't know if people understand, but one of the biggest issues that we face is not so much the suppression of the medicine, but it's the research of it. You know, when these large pharmaceutical companies are making donations to the University of Maryland in the millions of dollars, and we want to do a $200,000 sleep research project for cannabis, there's zero chance that they're ever going to accept that. I mean, we saw University of Baltimore who has a fairly strong pharmacy school, right? And we see that they're going to go out and try to do a clinically focused kind of dispensary technician, I think is, I don't know what they were calling it, something of that role, basically a dispensary agent training certification. And I see the article in the Baltimore Sun on like a Monday, and then like by like the second, third Wednesday, the article in the Baltimore Sun says University of Baltimore ceases to launch pilot program. And like, you know, it was a, you know, that that article comes out and phone calls are made to deans of schools and pressure. I mean, like our good friends at Wu-Tang said, cash rules everything around me. And when I look at it, it's truthful. I mean, and you know, one of the most, I think one of the largest catalysts to the cannabis growth right now is the fact that institutional investing is beginning to happen. Yeah. Big tobacco, big alcohol, they're coming in and flexing their weight.
Walgreens.
If you don't, if you right didn't see them, you know, they basically said we can either beat them or join them, and they can't beat us, so they're joining us. But it's just interesting, you know, to see those conglomerates, those just massive behemoths of institutions now coming in and trying to validate something that they've fought so hard to suppress.
And I think, well, I think when I see it also as like people, I mean, we see it all the time and everybody hears it all the time. People are trying to be healthier and more conscious, and like naturally they progress away from that kind of, and they're fed up with insurance companies and high premiums. And like, there's a bunch of factors that are just driving this, you know, switch, I guess you could say.
You talk about the advertising piece a lot. I don't know that necessarily consumer advertising for pharmaceuticals gets as much attention as it should.
It's a terrible idea.
It is a terrible idea. But what are we, about 15 years into it now? 20 years?
20. I just put something on Facebook not long ago.
I saw
about,
that.
Yeah.
So about 20, probably. The point that I'm trying to get at is that I think the myth is over. Like, I think, honestly, and I'm just speaking from very personal, but my father, I think, believed in this idea that, like, you know, I don't necessarily need to monitor my blood sugar because I'm on insulin, and I don't necessarily need to lower my blood pressure because I'm on blood pressure medication. I don't necessarily need to take these corrective actions in my life, because there's a pill for it. And like, taking a pill seems so much easier than eating healthy or like changing my behavior. And I think it's finally resonated to people in their 50s, 40s, 30s, and 20s that like, no, it's lifestyle, and like things like sugar matter and things like
exercise. I don't tell you that anymore. I mean, patient cured is a customer lost, you know? So why would a doctor tell you to take a walk and lose some weight and come visit him less often because you're doing better now, when instead he can have a guaranteed every 3-month visit if he puts you on blood pressure medication, some cholesterol medication? It's like, come back
in
3 months.
Some of it's malicious. I think some of the doctors just believed it. Like the opioid stuff. I think there's doctors that were taking money in from the pharmaceutical companies, and they were as malicious and as foul as possible. I think there was a lot of doctors, as someone who's started to talk to doctors now, they're like robots. They're trained. I mean, they're
but
very
it's still,
institutionalized.
It's negligence on their part. Yeah. If you've got some, you know, blonde girl that used to have her sales record in Ulta makeup, who's now working for a drug company because she's got a great sales record, do you take your trusted professional information from her? Seriously?
No.
I mean, and that, unfortunately, is where they get it from. And when you read these lawsuits and these cases, they full on admit that they hired these, like, beautiful people to spew this nonsense to doctors so that they would believe it. But as a pharmacist, if someone would come and tell me those things, I would feel inclined to go see if it sounds
research.
Too good to be true.
Yeah.
It is.
Do a little bit of research.
Look it up. But then when we try to talk to them about cannabis, we're selling snake oil. Yeah, I mean, it's I have issues with like this they didn't know kind of thing. Like, I think you kind of knew a little bit.
No, yeah, I agree. I agree. It's negligence.
I have a 12-year-old daughter,
not malicious.
In second grade, one of her friends fell off the monkey bars, goes to the emergency room, leaves with a prescription for oxycodone. Like, that shouldn't be happening. You know, and a lot, there are parents out there that, you know, as a pharmacist, I saw moms that would show up with sick kids day after day after day, a stubbed toe, an ingrown toenail, a dental problem, this, that. Like, when you start putting it out there that you're okay with giving medications like that to kids, the seekers come out of the woodwork. And, you know, a lot of it just got kind of
it's crazy
too far
because,
gone.
You know, you've been out of pharmacy now for a couple of years, but you were in it through the thick
of the worst
of basically before anyone ever used the word opioid epidemic. Mary Pat's at Riverside Pharmacy watching people sell to the rehab place that's three doors over their prescriptions. I mean,
my first job out of school, we had Ritalin, we had Dilaudid, and we had Percocet in the safe. And that was it. And it got open like once or twice a week.
Three things in the safe. How many things would be in the safe now?
I mean, if you had a decent selection in varied doses for ADD for pain, hundreds.
Three to hundreds in 20 years.
It time flies right now.
But that's not to say that that's all that was available. It's just that it wasn't
controlled
used
often. Like used.
And, you know, if you had your wisdom teeth out, they'd give you 4 Percocet and then Advil. Or if you were really in that much pain, you'd be in a better setting to control pain. It's not like they're going to.
That was the big myth, right? Is the fact that opioids can be used more appropriately for long-term pain. I mean, that's the biggest lie ever told with the precedent of a lot of these lawsuits is that Purdue
Safe and
Pharma
effective for long-term.
Yeah, these folks, they really manipulated the FDA's approval for safe and effective for long-term use. And that's, you know, you're right. The doctors have a piece of that, but at the same time, they're so dependent upon these approvals, and it's just if someone tells them it's safe and effective for long term use, and they're scared to, you know, I don't want to use morphine or I don't want to use these other things. It's crazy to me that, like, I don't know that scandal happened and literally.
But it, I mean, I don't know think that about it. Probably happens all the time. I mean, how much happens that we don't know about?
Time.
When you think of all these, you know, recalls and the way things get peddled through in a way, you know, a brand name drug will suddenly be recalled because they realize it didn't go through the proper patenting process years ago. And now it's back and costs $300 a month. And it's like an old gout medication used to be, you know, $10 a month. Now it's 200. I mean, it's crazy what they do.
It's crazy to me that the opioids, though, is like our sheriff's office has a sign up for how many people OD and die. Like Mary Pat sends me this, in my opinion, kind of bullshit email, but I understand it. That now every pharmacist in Maryland is able to distribute Narcan.
Standing order.
And like, I don't get me wrong, like, I think there's a place for that. But if you guys think about how we just talked about the profit margins of these companies, if now there's a standing order that everyone can just routinely sell your product, like, you're killing it, like, on something that's just like, it's preventing people from overdosing, but it's not, it's actually making it safer to abuse heroin.
That's where I would think is that people would just say, oh, I can just go get Narcan wherever. I'm just going to go to, you know, I'll go to the local pharmacy, load up on Narcan, and I can just do whatever I want.
And why? I mean, if in my logic, then Mary Pat uses the same analogies, then how come there's not universal insulin? Like, how come there's not, like you can't pick and choose necessarily to, like, promote these things like Narcan, because what it does is it puts extreme profit margin and value to that business. And it's just, I don't know. It's crazy to me that so many people are affected by one substance or like one type of substance. And who's someone in a substance business who sells a controlled dangerous substance according to our government. And I look around me and I have to compare everything as a substance now. Like, my vision, that's how I look at everything. I look at, like, sugar, alcohol, cocaine, meth, mushrooms. Like, everything is just a substance to me. And, like, depending on how you use that substance depends on how dangerous that substance really is. I mean, if we're going to look at some of the anecdotal research that's coming from really progressive places out west in terms of utilizing mushrooms for alcoholism and things like that, then you have to give some value that every substance should have some applicable value, and every substance probably doesn't have an applicable value. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people that were in very serious car accidents that if it wasn't for an opioid to really take care of that pain for that short period of acute time of 3 days before they went
on,
they would have told you the story of how they had the most excruciating pain for the first 72 hours after their their back surgery.
And they have their place, but the problem is that when you are not told and warned about the addiction potential and something is labeled 1 to 2 every 4 to 6 hours as needed, your first instinct is, I'm going to take 2 every 4 hours. And that is, your body probably doesn't need that. Try 1 every 6. And I think as soon as you feel that pain, you run right back to it. And it just continues. And it's sad that it was funneled into our society through the FDA by drug companies. Like the biggest, healthcare is a business and an industry. It's not really healthcare anymore. And it's sad because I think you look at people, honestly, like us, like who don't have health insurance through an employer, and like we really get jacked. I've spent my life in pharmacy and can't afford my inhalers, you know. And there's how many people out there that pay nothing for health insurance, and controlling costs is all such a big part of what would help this out.
I've only been like a, you know, this like parent 30 something for a couple of years now, but like I just don't remember the conversations around health insurance being so topical 10 or 15 years ago. I don't remember families struggling to pay a premium and then that didn't even cover an office visit. Like, they're all like new. And I truly think that healthcare is evolving and is changing as we speak. If you don't recognize it, I think there's a momentum now that in 15 or 20 years, the way that we pay premiums, the way that we utilize doctors, the preventative medicines that we would start utilizing instead of just trying to have a broken fix mentality, I think it's going to have to, because it's not affordable to be. I think as I talk through this, it's almost like they've made it unaffordable to be unhealthy anymore.
Yeah, that's like, a good way to look at it.
Like it used to be like, there's still a great piece of population that have subsidized medicine. I'm not talking about that. But if you think about just the average person like myself, like, health insurance is not something that I have right now. Like I'm very in tune to how I'm eating and like I'm paying attention to a lot more things around my health. And being a parent brings a lot of that awareness as well. But it's just, I think, as it becomes more expensive to see a professional, as people, no one wants to go to the hospital. Before there was, 10 years ago, you broke your pinky, I'm just going to go to the hospital. Now you get a bill.
Wait it out, girl. Wait
now
it out.
Now you get a bill, $1,500. Right. You know what? We're going to wrap this and we're going to go to urgent care and get us a $200 bill instead of one of them fancy $1,500.
Put some CBD on. It'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Just bring them CBD. That's what I tell my girls all the time.
You guys are coming to my world. That's the way I've always operated.
My daughter got sick. It was 6:30 at night. Doctor's office closed. Go to the urgent care. It's my first option because I know it's going to be less expensive than the hospital. She wasn't dying. She didn't need to go to a trauma or emergency room. And
that's what my daughter just had to get stitches above her eye, right to in and out. PM pediatrics, no hospital needed, just easier.
I think we're going to see more of these like a la carte style medicines. I think physicians, as insurance and as things become harder to navigate, I don't know. I just think we're going to be closer. I think we've gotten away from our physicians. We've gotten away from our doctors. And I think there's in the future, just by the nature of things, or maybe just it'll be the folks, there'll just be options to have this like homeopathic route that I now believe in. And maybe that's just, it'll just be a segment that just traditional medicine stays the same, but a segment of the population just starts more migrating more towards like alternative medicines and homeopathic medicines. And don't get me wrong. I mean, vaccine our kids, or give my kids all the farm. It's not like, we have a lot of patients that because of pharmaceuticals and cannabis are living their best life. Right. Definitely. So it's not like this, I'm not here to motherfuck all pharmaceuticals, but it's such a broken system. And like, as someone who's, I constantly compare what we do to operating like a cannabis pharmacy, and I see how real pharmacies operate, and I see how real insurance companies operate, and I see, this is a great topic to go on for a few seconds. Everyone out there says, man, can't wait till insurance companies start paying for cannabis, right? Well, you have a jaded Dr. Hoffman here who knows what happens when insurance companies get involved in something, and it becomes capping.
They would cap THC limits, or they would cap a quantity, they would cap dose, they would cap strains. And this industry is so new. How can you cap a dose on someone when you think of some of our patients and how much they're using for some of their more severe conditions? What right does an insurance company have to say, well, you can't use that much?
Yeah.
If they would contribute to it would be fine, but I think that any direct involvement would just be.
I think eventually, like, kind of I think if federal regulations. Like HSA it. If like a federal regulation, that would be sweet.
Yeah. Did you think of our friend up in Delaware who is sick.
Yeah.
And, you know, has mounting crazy bills on her own despite her insurance, then trying to supplement with cannabis to really just kind of help her keep it all together and feel better. That's all out of pocket, all of it. So on top of these, gosh, God love her, probably hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical bills, she's trying to do this too.
I think somewhere there's a Corpon like guy sitting at Aetna right now saying, all right, Purdue Pharma wants $17.35 for their dose of, you know, post-surgery opiate, and we can pay $15 for a gram. That's a cost savings of $3.53, and they're less likely to need counseling services and all this other shit after on the back end.
Or we could Epidiolex them for $32,000 a year.
Yeah, I mean, so there's that piece of it. Back to Big Pharma. So for those folks unfamiliar, the 13 people that listened to our hemp episode, obviously not as compelling as weed.
We didn't break the internet on that one.
We talked a little bit about the FDA approving GW Pharmaceuticals, Epidiolex, and if we were to, if a patient came to us seeking a similar style treatment, I don't know. Even at the highest, if they were using a lot of CBD, maybe $300 a month at the highest, I think.
I'm not sure what those doses were based on, but it's an isolate as well. You know, it's
not even full spectrum.
It's not full spectrum.
That's the best
thing. That's the best part about it.
Best part about it for us from a regulatory standpoint, a patent standpoint. Long story short, it's $2,400 a month, correct?
We have a mom who's trying to get it for her daughter, and I don't know if she's gotten the approval, but I told her, I said, if not, don't worry about it, because we can recreate that here without insurance involvement. And
the point I'm trying to make here is that basically you're looking at about 8 times the cost of a traditional regimen within our dispensary is what happens when Big Pharma tries to bring the same exact regimen to the people. I mean, that's the big concern with the FDA. Like, everyone's, oh, FDA should just deschedule. Well, let's be careful with what path the FDA takes with cannabis, because if you get the wrong players in there, and you can assure that Big Pharma already has the interest of the FDA in hand, you might not like the outcome that you get.
Could screw all of us.
Yeah. So these things are all very, it's like we're in murky water, and you really can't tell which way is best at this point as these things kind of develop. So, so that's that. So I can convince, you'll say I convinced you to join our team. Tell everyone what your experience was like during the application process. And also, I guess I'll preface the question with this, because it's a little bit of a loaded question, but when you were doing your research for our good friend in Delaware, your little old bitty, there was like nothing there, right? I mean, this was
the internet wasn't what it was. You figure it was like 2003, so you could search for things, but like, I don't
Were you asking Jeeves?
And I probably was like, from a dialogue, I don't even think I use the word cannabis. You know what I mean? Cannabis is new in this whole thing to us. Like, I feel like there wasn't as much out there, and it was more anecdotal stuff. Research, now there's a lot of, you can find a lot of clinical studies and stuff if you look for them. But back then it just hadn't made it on there yet. So it was tough to find concrete evidence, I guess you would say, just because it wasn't, we weren't loaded up the way we are, even though some of those studies have been done. But you know, a 5,000-year safety record, it's hard to argue with.
Sure.
So with that, I just, you know, if she's comfortable with the act of smoking, then have at it.
Sure.
And so she did.
10 years later, right, 2013, now you go back and you're kind of tasked with helping us write this application. How was that process? And
so interesting. I mean, I thought I knew a lot when we started. Come to find out, I didn't know a damn thing. Started from the beginning, got a couple good books, read them, and then when I would find something in my reading that would
shout
interest
out to
me,
Dr. Michael Backus.
Yes, Michael Backus, Cannabis Pharmacy, Bonnie Goldstein.
Yeah.
You know, when I would find something that was kind of intriguing or had a reference, I would follow that up. And it's crazy that even now, what are we, that was what, 4 years ago that we worked on that?
2015.
Yeah, so even now I go back and I look at my...
2015, like almost our four-year anniversary.
Look at that initial, like the initial way that I answer those application questions and just like the initial, my notes and my research, so elementary. Like there's so much out there even now compared to just 4 years ago. I think one of the questions was, you know, discuss cannabinoid, how a clinical director will... educate on cannabinoids and terpenes, and I just kind of like listed them, and we'll talk about that. I'll make sure that we learn all about them. But
all six of the ones.
I mean, like terpenes. I seriously, in that first training guide, I think there were six terpenes listed with, like, you know, I think I said like linalool, lavender, relaxing, and now linalool's a page. So it's just wild the stuff that's out there, and it's crazy to me that so many of my colleagues that are in pharmacy and doctors and nurses and the whole healthcare field acts like this whole entire field doesn't even exist. And it's one thing when it was back in the day and you were just, you know, people were smoking weed and saying, oh, this helps this or that. But we have evidence now and we have research. We have lab-based research. We have scientific research. We have anecdotal evidence. We've got doctors following patients and we know about the endocannabinoid system and CB1 and CB2 receptors and GPR receptors and TRPV receptors. So when you know that all these things exist and you are in healthcare, learn about it. I mean, how can you kind of accuse us of selling our snake oil when our snake oil is backed by concrete scientific evidence and research?
And even if you don't agree with it specifically, your patients very well might, and they're going to have to know how it interacts with the other stuff
exactly
they're prescribing them and how it fits into their healthcare regimen.
So if nothing else, just honor their choice as that they've made as a patient, because I think it's hard to argue our patients have seen some super great things from their cannabis therapy. I mean, reached some milestones. When I presented at the Cannabis Science Conference, I went over a couple of our patients and just how far they've come. One guy, 68-year-old, started, he was chronic pain, anxiety, depression, insomnia. He's taking 20 tablets a day for over 25 years. He doesn't take anything now at all. I mean, he uses different mixes.
He was a patient at the pharmacy.
That's
super important. Like,
so I followed him for a long time and just seen a total change around in him.
So real quick, the Cannabis Science Conference is a national conference that for the very first time, Josh Crosley puts it on, came to Baltimore. There was only a very few select folks from Maryland that were picked to speak. Dr. Altman was one of them. And your presentation was titled Same Patients, New Outcomes. Or
Same Patients, Same Problems, New Options, New Outcomes.
And the premise was some of these patients have literally been patients of Dr. Altman's for 20 years, but only with cannabis patients the last year, and 19 years of masking and addressing some issues versus like literally fixing them, right?
Helping your body just rebalance itself, right?
This gentleman at 68, he's super active. I see him in the gym every time that I'm there. It's amazing to me that he was living that life
in the shape he was in, right?
In the shape that he was in.
Yeah.
And now that I see him, he's so energized. He's a professional. He's done a lot of testimony. He's very proud of his success, and it's really amazing. And then we had a couple other patients too, right? So we had
an MS patient, was able to get off of bladder control medication, her Neurontin, some muscle relaxers, anxiety
medication.
She's pretty much just taking a patch now. Yeah.
And she's literally just cutting a patch up, and that's like, it's a.
And I think she might be on some one-to-ones.
The patch is like the biggest piece of relief for her. Literally just a patch that she cuts in half and places, and it's basically a slow release. She uses THC indica, I think, correct?
Yeah, she is a indica dominant patch, and she likes a CBN patch as well. 2-to-1 trochees.
And then the last is a patient that, you know, was really close to our dispensary. Actually lost this was a gal who is 30 something years old with a mentality of an 11 or 12 year old. She was given a vaccine, right?
When she was seven months old,
spiked a crazy fever, and basically is now mentally impacted for the rest of her life in a way that she's 30 and kind of lives her life as an 11 or 12 year old. Her mom came to us really at the end of her rope. The daughter basically was suffering from bouts of aggression, seizures.
She's one of our first patients.
She was one of our very first patients. And then subsequently, the mother passed away, and we were kind of in charge of helping this patient continue on her therapy, and to much avail. Actually, her dad just texted me this morning. Nice. This patient literally was having 3 to 4 seizures a week. And then when she, before and after seizures, would have these crazy bouts of aggression. And she was able to, through taking a 1-to-1 pill 3 times a day with some additional therapies for kind of breakthrough issues, go to 1 to 2 seizures a month. I mean, just a complete change in lifestyle. And something that people don't always think about in this particular case was the caregivers of this patient were so taxed trying to take care of a large 32-year-old woman who is acting like a child in most cases, and then having seizures and things like that. To reduce that burden on the caregivers was incredibly important in this particular situation. And the caregivers were non-believers of cannabis as a therapy tool for this particular lady. And now are actually patients in our dispensary. Well, when
you
look at
so many of these cannabis superheroes are moms, you know, are moms who cared for their own children and just figured that they have to change laws. I mean, look at Janie and Riley, look at Gail. We've got so many heroes in this industry that started out as an advocating mom.
So after we got approved, I want them to hear the story of the pharmacy magazine coming out the day after Christmas. And then I also want to hear what the reaction from some of your peers were. Because I know not everyone was negative, but not everyone was positive either, right?
Yeah, so I was contacted by someone after the licenses were released that they just wanted to talk to a Maryland licensee. So I did an interview with her for Marijuana Times. And, you know, she said, I'll let you read it before it comes out. I'm going to hold it. I know holiday season. So, you know, just I'm going to interview you now. I'll just kind of put it on the back burner. So I was sitting there on the couch late. Was it Christmas or the day after Christmas?
Day after, it was December day 26th, I'm positive.
Late at night, and I want to say it was like 11 o'clock, and I get on Facebook, and there I am tagged in a post. And at this point, no one knew what I was doing.
Everything had been undercover. I mean, to write an application, there's really, as we were smart to do, no reason to go on a public grandstand tour and tell everybody that you're trying to apply or even that you just have a license. Most of the folks that did the most boisterous and loud promotion of themselves before the application, they did not get licenses and they look kind of silly. So no one knows. And then all of a sudden this article comes out. And at this point, you were either teaching at UMS?
Asked by Dr. Brissett in April of 2017 to teach selected topics in medicinal cannabis that started in January. No, I'm sorry. That was 2016. Started in January of 2017. So that was mentioned in the interview as well.
So the day after Christmas, I'm sitting at home, and in our application, we had an MOU, a memo understanding with UMES to do some kind of a partnership. So UMES gets mentioned in this press release, and literally the head of public relations for University of Maryland Eastern Shore is calling my cell phone the day after Christmas because he obviously has Google Alerts set up. So he's having his coffee on his two-week break.
Day after Christmas.
It sees University of Maryland Eastern Shore marijuana and basically spits his coffee out on his computer and has a conniption. It took some smoothing over.
You know, we made it work. And so, you know, I got all hot and just kind of was like, oh shit, because at the time, what was Molly, like 7 or 8? And that was a big part of it. I don't really care what people thought of me or, you know, my career as a pharmacist, because I figured at that point I was in a new space. But as a mom with a young daughter, of course, you worry, like, what are people going to think of you? Are people going to think you're some pothead that's been, you know, hanging out, smoking in your house while my kids are there? Are people's kids still going to be allowed? I just had all these thoughts. And then, you know, my parents, their friend, like, no one knew. No one else in my family even knew. My parents knew, my brother, my sister.
We didn't even know, right? Right. We don't have a finished product that we can say, look how long we've been doing this, or look how great we are in a community. Like, at this point,
we got a license.
We're telling people what we're going to do, but just telling them.
So I panicked a little bit and just tried to go to bed. And then the next morning I woke up and it was kind of crazy. I was flooded with support, which I figured was going to go one of two ways. It was either going to be like right on or holy shit, what have you been doing? And so as soon as I saw like the flood of support, those people were more important. They were the ones that mattered to me when I saw that it was like my friends, my daughter's friends, moms, people that I knew.
People came out of the woodwork, honestly. School. I think, truthfully, that was
childhood.
That was my coming out moment as well. Totally. Just because there was like 25,000 views. I mean, it was crazy.
It was a lot.
And I remember the same feeling as I'm a parent and we hadn't executed on this plan yet. And I knew there was going to be naysayers, but we hadn't really told anybody we were doing it yet. So this was, I felt like our chance to really get some pushback if we were going to get it. But it wasn't
that. We did. I mean, you know, there's always...
You're always going to have some.
Yeah.
There's some pharmacists that you were throwing your career away.
There's a couple pharmacists that I was throwing my career away, you know, that I don't know what I'm doing, but whatever. I totally believe in what I'm doing. I think there will come a time when they look back and say, maybe she would throw her career away. But yeah, it was rough. And it was kind of one of those things that like, this better work out because I, at this point, I don't think, you know, they think that I'm off the deep end and going in pharmacists selling weed now. So
there's a little bit of fate in all of this stuff. But like one thing that I think about is like I mentioned, we had some guests in the shop today. I was talking about, when we first opened up, like we had 6 products, right? Yeah. You know, we feel so great about
it. On a good day.
On a good day.
4 kinds of flour and 2 kinds of tablets.
That's right.
Oh, and the Elixir.
7,
right?
Sorry.
Yeah, 7 products.
We have over 160 SKUs right now at any given time. And, you know, I think about someone like yourself. I think it would be really painful if you would have done this in a state that had a shitty program. Like, if you left and did this in Delaware... And patients are coming in and you can't give them what they need. And like, you can, like, to Chuck and Corpon's ability to run our business in a way that allows us to really do this the way that we need to. And my vision and your ability to execute on this, our patients are truly able to be served and helped. And it's not like that in all dispensaries in Maryland. It's definitely not like that in all states. I mean, there are states that are so prohibitive in their programs that the black market basically prevails 9 out of 10 times. And if you're a pharmacist and you're going there to try to do good, you don't really have the opportunity or the product selection to be able to go. And like, we're getting new things in every day, like THCA. We've been asking for THCA for 9 months, but sure shit, it showed up.
Here it is. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's why I try to invite, you know, I've had a pharmacist friend come through. We've had a lot of healthcare professionals come through. And I like when they come visit because I think once they get over the initial shock of like, whoa, it smells like weed in here and see the jars and you take them to the medical products, I think it's shocking for these people who have such a I don't even know what their vision of what we do would be, but not very clear.
What do I do?
I think people just don't know. I remember like when I walked in the first time in Colorado or something, you just have no idea what to expect, and you kind of open the doors up and allow people to see it.
My first dispensary experience in Colorado was really, really weird. Like, the very first thing is I'm picturing like a cop to just like jump out, like, yes, call another one. And then like you get in there, and like for me, like as a law-abiding citizen, except for smoking weed, like it's always been this like caveat, because like I've always been very supportive of Leo. Like I've always just felt like an outcast because I smoke weed, and now I'm going to have this like legal experience, and I never been offered more than one kind of weed, right? Like,
there's jars
everywhere.
Here you go.
And like, I had had an edible, and so the edibles weren't mind boggling to me, but I never saw a drink.
Yeah.
Like, the drink just like, I remember being
you just drink it? Yeah.
For real? Like, yeah. Awesome. I bought a t-shirt because I was, I know, right? I'm sure that I was probably a little more giddy than I should have been, but I had always looked at weed as a medicine, and I felt like I wasn't, like, this idea that I could, like, not be breaking the law until I cross the state line with it.
I think that's huge for our patients, though. I mean, I think, I tell people all the time that I think that that is such an empowering decision. Just allowing them the freedom to come into the dispensary just puts so much power in their pocket that they feel like they have a better handle on their health. They're not being told, take this 3 times a day. They get to go to a dispensary and say, I want to smoke, I want a tincture, I want a tablet, I want oil to make an edible. They have a choice. And I think that sometimes just giving them that choice, they kind of feel like they can take, like,
they're helping their own hands
a little bit better. And they kind of almost want to do it because, like, I'm going to show that damn doctor that I'm, you know? It becomes like a challenge. And I think We've seen so many people. I mean, we've had family members come in to thank us for the way that what we do has changed their family dynamic.
It's cool how many family members have tried to buy patients gift certificates because they know it's like the most important thing to the patient. It's really, really neat. All right, so we've done a lot of kumbaya about how great everything is. You come from this traditional medicine background, and I don't, but I have an appreciation for moving cannabis towards that. If you had to be critical of either the program or even just like some of the restrictions on our dispensary, like what are some of the things that you think are like the biggest? Like, I know, like, not being able to serve out-state patients, right? Like that's.
So I think the MMCC, in the grand scheme of things, when you look at what other states have and what they allow, I think the MMCC has been phenomenal.
We all agree. Yeah. In case Joy's listening,
we all agree. I mean, just the communication with them. I think that their program is generous. I think that aside from that one time they had a big clump of patients, that I think approvals are going through quickly. I don't think it's overly cumbersome. I think the one area that bothers me is the whole education and clinical director. I feel like a lot of these... It concerns me that there's not a guaranteed education coming from the physician who is issuing a certification. Sometimes there are some great ones. But
they really are few and far between, because even the physicians oftentimes that are giving dosing recommendations, some of these dosing recommendations are so far off.
They're kind of from a book. They don't see the practical side of it. And I understand that, because as a pharmacist, I saw what was on paper. I didn't always see the response that those patients would go back and report. I understand the difficulty in education, dosing, suggestions, product selection, all of that. But then what bothers me is that you run the risk of walking into a dispensary and someone saying, what do you want? Because we know that that's happened. And if you're a mom caring for your child or caring for an elderly parent, or just don't know anything about this, if you're
you an older in, lady the bud with tender's got on a tie-dye shirt, he's called a bud tender, and he's like, hey, man, how you doing?
What do you want today?
Hey, what do you want?
I have no idea. I don't know.
What brings you in? Question. Right. Sometimes I went to
one dispensary, they just stared at me.
You know, or you can go push buttons on this thing on the wall that'll tell you what you should be buying and then come to us and order it. And that bothers me, because I think there are some patients out there that really need some help and guidance. And we've all seen it. If you use something that's not compatible with what you're trying to address, it's not going to be a pleasant experience. And so I think, you know, it's easy for people to have a poor experience and get the wrong impression, or have a poor experience and give up, or keep going. Some, we've had patients show up that have been at other dispensaries and feel like they spent a lot of money on improper products. And
for good, bad, or other, we do seem to attract the more serious cases, which is, I mean, that's honestly what we want it to be. But we do. We hear some pretty poor stories of how patients are being handled. Cutting patches in half and it works the same. I mean, just
cheaper. It's you know?
Cheaper. It's pretty ridiculous stuff.
And again, I know that wasn't really the MMCC. That was some fancy attorneys.
Here's a great story. How important the word shall versus may. So the original intention was is that every dispensary shall have a clinical director who is a pharmacist, nurse,
physician. I think it was just pharmacist or physician, honestly.
And then a couple of places, they weren't consistent. They used the word may. And literally, the difference between may and shall is yes or no. And the attorneys argued that may was used, and that's why you see a lot of dispensaries, they don't have a clinical director. And, like, I look at how they run their dispensary, and, like, it would be tough to find a pharmacist that would be willing to put their name on that type of a brand.
Yes, I agree.
You know, Street Price Tuesday and bullshit like that. Like, no medical professional wants to be a part of that. And I think if they had to have had that presence, we probably could have avoided some of that stuff. That's my whole thought about this, you know, the adult use coming to Maryland, is I think a lot of these dispensaries that claim to be medical dispensaries that don't run any way the clinical fashion that we run our dispensary, they're not even going to fake it. I mean, they're going to be running.
Yeah, I don't think they care.
They don't.
They don't care. That's the point.
And it's sad. And we do care. And I can tell you that, honestly, you're not always rewarded for caring. Like, our business model from a Excel spreadsheet, like, it's a struggle to continue to want to provide a level of care and improve our level of care inside the confines of an illegal federal business dispensary every day. And, you know, I think that as cannabis becomes more recognized, more, it seems like CB, it seems like the rest of the world is starting to acknowledge, like, THCA and, like, all these, like, rare cannabinoids. We're getting into, like, understanding, like, 30 terpenes. And the physicians are like, so I hear there's this thing called CBD. Like, I saw it at the Valero when I was filling up my bed.
CBDs are even better when there's more than one.
Yeah.
Well, you know about CBDs.
So, but I think as traditional medicine starts seeking out more information on CBD and more information on cannabinoids, that there will be a place for what we're doing, and that the value will be placed on the way that we run our business, not on just that go to Happy Hair. Not Happy. I don't want to.
Anyway, I loved Happy Harry's.
I know Happy Harry's is a good place. That's why I didn't want to mother apple. Whatever the Piggly Wiggly is to go pick up your weed versus going and having a consultation and getting a dosing guide and a regimen and actually taking a disciplined approach to changing quality of health conditions, which is cannabinoid-based wellness. I mean, I've stumped over and over again that I don't believe that there should be a differentiation between CBD and THC and the cannabinoids. It's all cannabinoid-based health. So, any other, you know, I think the physician thing is just huge. You know, we constantly talk about the lack of participation from traditional physicians for a variety of different reasons, whether it's regulatory restrictions or insurance restrictions or just apathy to learn stuff on their own. And until that piece of it changes, as long as cannabis-based therapy is treated as this obsolete thing in a silo and not part of comprehensive healthcare, like, it's going to struggle. And, like, I think, lucky for us, the patient outcomes are so significant that we're making waves in Salisbury, Maryland. Like, it's amazing to me. Like, sometimes I get defeated when I think about how far we have to go before doctors look at cannabis as any type of equal treatment to traditional therapies. But other times I get excited in thinking about how far we were just a year and a half ago, even just how we treated patients. I mean, if you came in a year and a half ago, we had 7 products to offer you, and we were trying to mix this and mix that.
Substitute the purple daddy.
I got more ratios in that one cabinet than we didn't even know what to do with. It's like, 11 didn't want to start 14 to 1. That didn't want to be 22 to 1. Let's go all day here. We have opportunities to adapt and change treatment protocols and really hone in on, because that person before we had 7 products, they came in and said, okay, you know what? Using this elixir at nighttime was helpful, but the best was actually utilizing a 2-to-1 troche with CBD and THC. Yeah. Like it's a difference between, you know, taking someone's pain from a 10 to a 7 to a 10 to a 3. And the more products that we get, and shout out to all the processors that are continuing to focus and give us, you know, we got 20% THC flower in right now. Like that's stuff that's like pretty tough to find in any state market. And Catatonic from Curio is testing at 20% CBD. I mean, that's an amazing tool for a lot of folks. So you have an old head that wants to smoke flower.
You tried it.
But needs CBD. I'm still on my Blue Dream CBD. That's actually been my daily driver in the morning now. 11% THC, as I was joking, which was more than you probably got in your bag of weed from your drug dealer. But it's fairly nominal compared to some of the products we have in the dispensary, and 5% CBD. And Blue Dream is a strain that I've always kind of just been attracted to for a lot of like the stimulating properties of it, but it calms my anxiety and it gives me a level of clear thinking. So I haven't tried Catatonic yet, and honestly, I don't know if I will. I do like some THC in my regimen, but if I was someone that was looking for just a straight CBD flower, that's about as good as you're going to get.
Yeah, for sure.
So, anything else? I mean, what do you, is there, do you think, like, what do you think is next for Maryland's program or programs in general? Like, do you think that eventually, like, state lines will start getting crossed and, like, we'll see?
State lines really depends on the whole federal thing. The out-of-state patients bum me out just because I've got a couple in Delaware I really wish that we could help. And I get it, and I understand that federal law is a federal law, but I also feel like when it's people's lives and health,
shit. And, I mean, we have a couple of friends in Delaware, and they post their pictures of coming back from chemo, and then they post that they went to the dispensary, and the dispensary didn't have a single strain of indica. And I'm looking at my board,
I got
13, and I'm just like, I just don't do anything,
right?
For anyone listening, but it's
sad.
The heartstrings, and like.
And I think also just geographically for some people, I mean, you think about how close to Delaware we are.
We're the regional medical center.
We're a lot closer than, you know, if you live in Delmar, it's so much easier for you to come to us than to have to go to, Lewis, or I don't even know where the other ones are. So I wish that out-of-state patients, I think that as we get to adult use, I think that medical dispensaries will stand out more. So if there wasn't any kind of clinical designation or anything given, I think there will be a time when you see the medical dispensaries are going to kind of stick to their model. People will know that that's where you can kind of go find help, because you wouldn't be a medical model if that wasn't what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I think patients eventually, in not too near future, they're going to be branding that they're going to recognize in multiple states, like the Curaleaf and the GTIs of the world, right? And then my thought is that will really be a catalyst for the cannabis knowledge to spread. So, like, when you look at Maryland and how fast our program has progressed, I would argue that it's progressed faster than almost any other program in the nation. I would assume that West Virginia isn't completely different, and some of these, like Arkansas and these new programs, because
the infrastructure's already in place and they've done it before.
It's becoming less
been
and
done
less
before,
nuancey and more kind of cut and dry. So, and like, if you're the breast cancer expert in California, then it's likely more and more easy for you to be able to teleconsultations in Maryland now, in West Virginia, and like these other states. And like, that's my vision, is that you will get these verticalized expertise within cannabis to say, I'm not a cannabis expert, but I'm a cannabis autism mom expert,
right,
or I'm a cannabis cancer expert. Very likely not, but you know, these different types of specialties that will be the kind of the route that folks will
definitely. I mean, there are people, if we have someone who needs help with pediatric seizure disorders or autism disorders, we know,
right.
you know, who we can shout out to for some improved guidance.
Much more too. Like,
yeah,
I think people will be less likely to just want
it's going to, and it's a demand. I think people are going to demand it eventually, right? Patients that we see now, they're going to demand that from professionals, and there's going to be this class of professionals who's going to marry their previous professional experiences with this newfound, just like you did, MP.
I mean, cannabis nurses are huge. Yep.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Laura, who works with us at Peninsula Holistics in our CBD brand, I mean, I was so excited to have her on board because you take someone who's got a strong nursing background and a really fundamental understanding of how cannabinoid-based medicine works, and they are a tool. I mean, they can really impact. Nurses are amazing. Like, shout out to nurses. Like, it's amazing how much they're the glue that makes kind of different pieces of the healthcare world work.
Yeah.
But when we talk to them, my personal experiencing of it, like when I was in the hospital with the baby and the nurses found out that I was doing, you know, that I have the dispensary, they were talking everything from healthcare outcomes to stocks. I mean, these gals were dialed in.
You know, nurses are in the trenches. Like, they see what really goes down. And when you're a nurse and you see someone suffering, you really don't care what research says or what this says or what that says. Your instinct is to help them. I could never be a nurse. Shout out to all of you guys.
Yeah.
But I think that just that part of them where they just want to help people and they just want to see their patients stop suffering, there's a place for that. You know, in hospice and in certain places where there's just not any other option, cannabis provides an option where there isn't one to so many patients. And I think that nurses especially recognize that. And they just, at the end of the day, if this is going to help a patient, let them have it. You know, they see what really goes on, and not only the patient, they see the impact that illness has on extended family and caretakers. And, you know, Cannabis Nurse Heather started Cannabis Nurse Network, and they do so much throughout the country. A lot of educational series. A lot of them spoke at the Cannabis Science Conference. So I think, you know, people listen to nurses.
Yeah. So this could be the first of several opportunities to have you on. Thank
like
you
a solar eclipse, Darby.
I think we'll end on that. My solar eclipse partner.
Anthony Darby, podcast number
five.
Tune in, like, share. Charles?
Yeah, all good. Thanks for listening again. Continue to support the podcast. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. See ya.